Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Brad Brandon on the persecution crisis between Christians and Muslims in Nigeria.
And the Fulani are an extremely tight-knit community, and they're prone to violence. That's their culture. That's their people. And so they come back and retaliate. Even just several weeks ago, there was a massacre of 200 Christians between Fulani herders and Christian farmers. And it all started, the catalyst of it is that controversy between herders and farmers.
Brad Brandon next. Brad Brandon is a pastor and founder and CEO of Across Nigeria. He says over the past 10 years, northern Nigeria has risen to the top of the list as the most dangerous place to be a Christian. Spencer Dahlke is with Brandon to discuss his piece, The Silent Slaughter, Inside Nigeria's Christian Persecution Crisis.
First question for you, I just wanted to ask about how many Christians there are in Nigeria.
Yeah, so Nigeria is a huge country with a large population, and it's basically broken down to be about 50% Christian and 50% Muslim. I think there's just slightly more Muslims in Nigeria than there are Christians, but it's pretty evenly split. The issue is that most of those Christians live in southern Nigeria, and most of the Muslims live in northern Nigeria. So when you're talking about Nigeria, you're really talking about two different cultures and almost two different countries, the difference between north and south, south being predominantly Christian and the north being predominantly Muslim. There's probably about 2% or 3% of the population that still practice what we call in Nigeria traditional, which is like black magic.
You wrote in the Daily Wire a little piece on persecution crisis, I think, between Christian farmers and what you call Fulani Muslim herders. Would you care to tell us about who are these people?
Where the populations of Christians and Muslims converge, there is a huge crisis going on right now between, as you mentioned, Fulani herders, and they're predominantly 97% Muslim, and Christian farmers. It just so happens that in this region of the world, most of the Christians are settled, and so they are farmers. They have crops, they have farms, and most of the Muslims in this area, Fulani Muslims anyway, are herders. Fulani people are more nomadic. They move around throughout the year depending on the rainy season, and so they tend cattle. And when you're grazing cattle in areas where farmers are trying to grow crops, it often creates problems because those cattle go onto those farmlands and they graze and they rip up the crops and they eat the crops. And really, it destroys the farmer's way of life or means of living for that entire season. That really is the basis of the crisis between herders and farmers, although it's much more complex than that, but that's kind of a 30,000 foot view of the crisis that's going on. And it's killing thousands and thousands of Christians every single year. What ends up happening are the Christians come out, they chase the cattle off of their land, and usually some kind of conflict ensues from that. And then there's a battle and there's a fight. And the Fulani are an extremely tight-knit community, and they're prone to violence. That's their culture. That's their people. And so they come back and retaliate. Even just several weeks ago, there was a massacre of 200 Christians between Fulani herders and Christian farmers. And it all started, the catalyst of it is that controversy between herders and farmers. There's much more to it because there's obviously a religious aspect to it. But when you talk about the conflict between Muslims and Christians in regards to the Fulani and Christians, it's not like the Fulani are jihadists, terrorists, and sometimes the media paints them that way. That's not what the conflict is about at all. It's more just a clash of culture in a socioeconomically depressed area where people are just trying to survive, and people do desperate things when they're trying to survive.
You mentioned it's a complicated crisis. For the sake of being fair, do we happen to know how many Muslims maybe have also died from this conflict?
Yeah, there's definitely Muslims who get killed. In fact, the Christians retaliate often. They're prone to killing Muslims as well. In fact, in an area where I work extensively, that happened, where there were Muslims who were killed. We don't know the exact number of Muslims because it's not as closely watched. But last year, there were approximately 6,000 Christians that were killed in and around the northern Nigeria area. It is the most persecuted region in the world right now in regards to Christians. 70% of all the Christians that were killed in the entire world. So if you take all of the Christians that were martyred for their faith last year, 70% of them were killed in northern Nigeria. But to answer your question, we don't know the exact number of Muslims that are killed, but there certainly are Muslims that are killed, even in terrorist acts. Recently, there was a suicide bomber in northern Nigeria that walked into a restaurant and blew himself up. It was an operative of Boko Haram, which controls a lot of the regions in northern Nigeria. Predominantly in that restaurant, there were more Muslims than Christians in that restaurant that were killed. So yeah, there definitely are Muslim victims in all of this as well.
I think it's I'm not going to remember the organization. It's either the Voice of the Martyrs or another...
Open Doors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think maybe mentioned North Korea happened to see the most persecution of Christians.
When they talk about that, that probably is true as far as persecution. But when you're talking about deaths, number of deaths, Northern Nigeria has had that level for a long time. In fact, in 2022, that number was as high as 90% of all the Christians killed in the world in 2022. 90% of them were killed in Northern Nigeria. But as far as general persecution, there's all kinds of different levels of persecution. There's making Christians second-class citizens, taking their property, seizing their bank accounts, keeping them depressed. There's certainly other areas that are persecuted as well. But in the way of number of deaths, Northern Nigeria at least had that record for the last 7 years that I'm aware of, hands down.
It's easy for Americans to kind of think that Islam is just a very violent religion. A friend of mine was trying to correct me a little bit, saying that it's because it's more of an orthoprax religion, you know, it's more about practice than belief. The Quran is a very violent book. Do you think Islam is behind the taking up of the violence? Well, maybe that's a redundant question. You did talk about the economic depression in the area.
There's a lot of factors to it. To just simply paint Muslims as all a bunch of jihadists and all concerned about violence and look out for the Muslims. Some of my very good friends who I've worked with for years in Nigeria are Fulani Muslims or Hausa Muslims. I don't see Muslims as Muslims. I see them as grandparents, parents, fathers, mothers. So to me, I have a much more detailed view of that. When I think of Muslims, I think of Haji Gombo, which is a friend of mine. He's a grandfather. He's a father. He's a son. And so I look at it a little more that way. It's easy because I think of often in the West, the media does a great job of painting Islam in that picture. Although there are some things about Islam that are very conducive to religion. The Quran is basically broken up into two parts. One is pre-Mecca, one is post-Mecca. Pre-Mecca talks about peace. Muhammad talked about living in peace with your neighbors and all of these things. Post-Mecca, he really changed his ideology to much more violent. That's where the Quran talks about killing the infidel. Most Islamic scholars will say, well, the post-Mecca abrogates the pre-Mecca, meaning that it's kind of like the Old Testament versus the New Testament. The New Testament abrogates the Old Testament. Well, in Islam, it's reverse. The radicalized imams will say, well, that's reverse. Now we live by the violence. Now we live by kill the infidel and all the things that Sharia law calls for. There's many more peaceful Muslims who take the peaceful aspects of the Quran and live by those. The problem is that even if there's 1% or 2% of the Muslim population that's radicalized and into violence, you're still talking about millions and millions of people. And so I think that's where a lot of the problems come in. Now, Islam often, what would you say, it prospers in areas that are economically depressed. And so when you're economically depressed, you tend to gravitate toward violence. I happen to know people who have joined Boko Haram, not because they're into the ideology of Boko Haram, but because they're just trying to survive. They get money, at least they get food, they get meals, they get opportunities to make more money, because Boko Haram will pay upwards of anywhere from $50 to $100 for an act of violence. And in that part of the world, that's a small fortune. So there's a lot of complicated factors that go into this. And I say that it would be inaccurate just to say that, well, all Islam advocates for violence.
You talk a lot about, you know, the depression. And even in your article with the Daily Wire, I think you suggested that there's just not enough land in Nigeria to support both the Christian farmers and the Muslim herders. Why do you think that is? Where is all the land going?
Well, here's the issue is, you know, the seasons in Nigeria are divided into rainy seasons and dry seasons. You can't grow anything in the sand during the dry season. What you tend to see in northern Nigeria particularly is an increase in the violence and an increase, what we call in Nigeria, the crisis, toward the end of the dry season when things are getting extremely desperate. And then all of a sudden the rainy season comes and the downpour happens and the ground is refreshed and you can begin to grow crops and the cattle can range in areas or graze in areas that would normally be sand, but now they can at least graze on the weeds that are growing. In the dry season, it's totally different. And so the violence is just much more prominent during those times. So to ask, it's not necessarily a shortage of land as much as it is a shortage of land to grow crops and land to graze cattle. During the dry season, it's greatly reduced. And at the end of every dry season, you can count on it. There's going to be more and more violence as the dry season prolongs.
The other organizations you were talking about were the Boko Haram. I think you also wrote about ISIS. I'm not going to know how to pronounce it. ISIS WA or something to that effect.
It's just called the Islamic State of West Africa. That's the ISIS of West Africa. And so we just call it ISWA. It's just the acronym for the Islamic State of West Africa. That's another group that controls a lot of the areas that we work in. Boko Haram is the big one. And of course, ISWA and Boko Haram join forces at times. And there's even conflict between ISWA and Boko Haram as far as territory. It's a lot like gang mentality in northern Nigeria. But Boko Haram is the most dangerous one. They started in 2002. And since 2002, they're responsible for approximately 60,000 people being killed, most of them Christians. So in the article that I wrote for the Daily Wire, I mentioned that it is a genocide against Christians. And that's exactly true. It is a genocide that's happening. And not many people in the West, not many Christians here even know that it's happening.
One of the concerning things that you wrote about was that the government and its police force or its military, whatever you want to call it, won't do very much. Is that right?
Let's break it down like this. Under the previous president, he was a Fulani Muslim. And so there tended to be a lot more overlooking or what would you say, kind of ignoring the violence that the Fulani Muslims were causing in northern Nigeria. And I would say to that, yeah, that they were allowing that to happen. They were actually encouraging the violence to happen in the north for various reasons. Now there is a president, Bola Tinubu, who is a Muslim, but he's married to a Christian. So he's much more sympathetic to the atrocities that are happening. So although I think President Tinubu is probably trying to make some changes finally after all these years, the Nigerian military is just underfunded and under-equipped. When I talk about Boko Haram and ISWA, a lot of people think, oh, these must be, you know, a bunch of barbarians living in caves in the desert. that may be somewhat true. They live in the desert, but they're very technologically advanced. They use social media to their advantage. They use drones to their advantage. They are very well equipped, very well funded from, they're not funded by Arab governments as much as they're funded by other very wealthy Arabs in other Arab countries, send millions and millions, if not billions of dollars into West Africa to fund the operations of Boko Haram and ISIS. So there is no shortage of resources that they have. So now the issue is the Nigerian military gets involved and they run up against Boko Haram and they're outgunned, they're outmanned, they're out-resourced. In fact, in that article that you mentioned, this was probably about 3 years ago, I witnessed Nigerian soldiers walking off the job when they were ordered to hold back Boko Haram soldiers because they basically told me it's a suicide mission. They have better cars, they have better guns, they have, you know, they're just outmanned and outgunned. So I wouldn't say right now it's an issue of volition or unwilling to do it. I would say it's more an issue they're not able to at this point. The Nigerian military is just not able to go up against Boko Haram head to head.
My understanding is you're part of this organization across Nigeria that helps to alleviate the conflict between the Muslims and Christians there. Is that right? What do you guys do?
You know, if people want to go to our website, it's acrossnigeria.org, and it tells everything that we do. But the two tenets of what we do to help in this crisis, number one, is we start schools in Fulani Muslim communities. I'm a Christian, and I believe in sharing the love of Christ with everyone. And that means that the Bible calls us to bear fruit, the fruit of the Spirit. And I find it interesting that the Bible uses that word fruit, because fruit is the reproductive organ of a plant. So as we walk about bearing the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, all of those things, what it's meant to do is reproduce faith in the lives of the people around us. So we go into Fulani Muslim communities and we bear the fruit of the Spirit. And in that, we hope that we are going to plant the seeds of faith in Christ in these communities. But we'll go in and show the love of Christ to Fulani communities that have a history of killing Christians. And one of the best ways that we do that is we start schools in Fulani Muslim communities where we use the Bible to teach their children to read and write English. And if you can read and write English in northern Nigeria, well, that's like having a college education in that area. And it opens up so many doors of opportunity. It opens up doors to be able to prosper. What we've seen in every area that we have established a school, we've seen the violence drop by anywhere from 60 to 70%, measurably 60 to 70%, simply by giving those communities options. Another way that we do that is we travel into areas where these crises are happening. We go into areas where the violence is at its peak, and we do what we call peace tours through these areas. And in these areas, we'll give peace talks. And we just go into the community and talk to them about the value of peace, the cost of violence, and the value of peace. And we give very practical applications to that. Like the cost of violence is when a Christian poisons the grass for Fulani herders grazing their cows and it kills a herd of cow. Does that just hurt the Fulani Muslim? Or does that also hurt the Christian who buys the meat in the market? And now because the supply has gone down, the price has gone up. When a herd of cows go into a farm, a Christian farm, and eat all the crops and destroy that crop for the year till the next growing season, does that just hurt the farmer? No, it hurts the Fulani who goes and buys the beans and the rice and the beets at the market. Now that the supply goes down because of the crops being killed, now the price goes up. So the cost of violence is much more than just what meets the eye. But also, if we learn to live in peace, if Fulani herders and Christian farmers learn to live in peace, there's a great prosperity because the herders have what the farmer needs, and that is the fertilizer that the cows produce. And the farmers have what the Fulani need, and that is the crops that they grow. So when we learn to work together, prosperity happens. So we give practical applications to that, and then we sit down and we broker peace agreements between Fulani communities and Christian communities. And we travel throughout northern Nigeria into some of the most dangerous areas in the world, areas controlled by ISWA, areas controlled by Boko Haram, areas that have historically had violence between Fulani herders and Christian farmers. And we sit down with them and broker those peace agreements. So far, we have brokered over 25 peace agreements between communities, and every one of those peace agreements has held. So there is an interest even in the Fulani Muslim community. They are looking for peace, and they're beginning to see the cost of violence in their own communities and in their own families.
You mentioned 25 peace treaties or some figure like that. Mm-hmm. I think I missed the exact figure. But
yep.
Does it work?
It does work. We talk to them about the cost of how many more of your children need to be killed before you realize that in order for you to have a future, a good future that your children want to live in, how many more of them need to die before you realize what's happening? We always ask them, do you think things are better now than they were 20 years ago? And every Fulani will say, it's way worse now. Okay, well, do you want that to continue for you and it to get worse and for the conditions to compound themselves? Or do you want things to get better? And peace is the key to getting better, those communities to heal and grow and prosper. When we point that out to them, they really see it and grab onto that. And so it does work. It really does work. And it does work to help people out of their socioeconomic problems that they have and give them options by being educated. I think less than 5% of Fulani children can read and write, and less than 10% of them attend school. So you can imagine in those communities, people are uneducated and illiterate, and they're basically stuck. Whereas if they have an education, they can read and write in their own language. They can read and write English. They have opportunities to go anywhere and do anything because they're very intelligent people and very hardworking people. So if they're given the right opportunities, they can do it and they seize those opportunities. But when they have no options and they feel desperate and they feel there's nothing else they can do, they'll resort to violence. And I'm not too sure that's any different than any other person on this planet. Put in those situations would probably resort to anything to feed their family and feed themselves.
It also strikes me, if you're teaching even some of these Muslim children, you're like raising a generation, which, I mean, there's still killing that's happening. Like you mentioned, there's the 200 Christians that died a month or two ago, but like another generation is being raised to like, more options for you. Let's not resort
to
this.
That's right. That's right. It's a huge problem. And, you know, for our organization to go in and solve that problem, we're not going to be able to do that. Not in my lifetime anyway. The problem is so big that even the work that we're doing, which is great and it's vast and we're doing great things and making a huge impact, it's really just putting a dent in the problem. But you're right. What we're doing is helping to raise future generations that have options. And that's what we're doing. We're sowing seeds now that we're hoping will reap the rewards later. And it probably will never happen in my lifetime, but the seeds that we're planting now will make a difference.
Well, I think I just have one last question for you. Understandably, real change, you know, to get out of the depression will have to come from within Nigeria. But is there something that the American church can do to support the country in those efforts and especially our church family?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that. You know, there's a two-prong issue or two-prong answer to that. One is, as Christians, we're called not only to love other Christians, but we're called to love people who aren't like us, people who don't have the same worldview as we do. And we're called to love them too. And I think that's part of what our organization does is we go out and show the love of Christ But there's also a part to that is we are also called to love and take care of our brothers and sisters in Christ. And in fact, in Hebrews 13, Paul talks about those who are suffering persecution, it should be as though we are suffering with them. Paul says it, as bound with them. And so I think a lot of times the American church looks at the persecution that's happening wherever it is. We are somewhat disconnected from that persecution. And so we look at it as though, you know, that's something horrible that's happening to them over there, and that's too bad. We'll pray for you. But really, Paul says, no, we should act as though it is happening to us. So I always ask Christians, what would you do if your son or your daughter or you were going through what they were going through? What would you want to have happen? You would want to receive help. You would want to get as much help as you could and as much support as you could from the people who love you. And I think that's really at the core of the answer is the church needs to wake up to the persecution that's happening. We need to get involved and stop pretending like it's happening to somebody else and start acting as though it's happening to us. And that means sending resources. And I always caution people, and you know, you can call me biased if you want to, but when you send resources to large organizations, particularly in Africa, rarely do the funds get to the field. Everybody takes a little piece of it on its way down, and it just doesn't get there. I've seen it time and time again. What you really need are micro organizations, and Across Nigeria is a micro organization. The reason why we are more effective in getting the funds and the resources to the field is because we bring it to exactly where it needs to go. It's not a huge macro organization that shotgun blasts the resources out there, and then everybody takes a little piece on its way down. No, we take those resources and we bring it to the people who need it and put the needs, we put the help for those needs in their hands. And so I think supporting financially organizations like Across Nigeria, if you're interested in doing that, it's acrossnigeria.org. Any micro organization will be able to bring it to the field and put the help in the hands of the people who need that. And I think most importantly, and I end with this because most people remember the last thing you said, is prayer. We need the prayer of the Western church, particularly the American church, to be lifting up those people who are suffering in prayer. And pray for organizations like ours who are reaching Muslims. God is doing an amazing work, opening the hearts of the Muslim community, not just in Nigeria, but around the world. God is really doing something. And so we find it very, I don't want to say easy, but simple to just present Jesus Christ and for Muslims to be open to experiencing that grace. So praying for our effectiveness through God opening the hearts of Muslims, and then also praying for those who are being persecuted and just asking God to strengthen them and provide for them. I think those are the two greatest things that the American church can do to help alleviate this issue.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Brad Brandon, founder and CEO of Across Nigeria. Go to acrossnigeria.org. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Matthew Traylor on retirement as a time for a renewed call to discipling ministry.
What we want to help men particularly understand is you have a purpose beyond your vocation. And if we start now while we're in our vocation, it's a great way to begin thinking about what am I doing now that's beyond and greater than my vocation? And how am I impacting the kingdom ultimately? It's really changing perspectives.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.